a culpable offense of these heads of state and these senior civil servants when they get back home.
Now, Italy was one of the European countries with colonies in Africa. Considering this colonial background, can African countries really trust that Italy has no nefarious intentions to further loot the continent's resources disguised as an investment or development plan?
First, let me just highlight one thing. While Italy actually colonized Libya, Eritrea, and parts of Somalia, and while it did temporarily occupy parts of Ethiopia, it never managed to colonize Ethiopia. We celebrate Ethiopia as one of the countries that fought off successfully a colonial power and remained independent throughout the season of colonialism. But having said that, yes, indeed, it is true. No African state has any reason to trust any European state when it comes to these kinds of agreements, especially those European countries that were formerly colonial powers in Africa. France, Germany before it lost its colonial possessions, Spain, Italy, and so on. We have no reason to trust. Every single interaction that we have had with our counterparts from Europe has ended up in exploitation and actually in neo-colonialism, new forms of colonialism.
One of Giorgia Meloni's key outcomes from her Africa plan is reducing unofficial migration. She claims that the new Italy-Africa plan aims to foster prosperity on the African continent as a way to remove one of the root causes of irregular migration to Europe. However, analysts say this approach to illegal migration will continue as long as Western powers, including Italy, continue looting Africa's resources.
This idea of hard borders of things called states are a relatively recent invention in human political, economic, and social history. They're basically 300 years old. People have always flowed from areas of want to areas of plenty, and they offer something in return for being allowed to stay there. So first, this concept of illegal migration is a concept that I have a problem with. Secondly, what we have seen is a whole range of European countries outsourcing their borders into Africa and outsourcing their migration obligations to African states so that African states try to block migrants from crossing into Europe. The problem is Africans are crossing into Europe because Europe is rich out of the resources that is looting from African countries. So the reality is Africans are following their resources into Europe. What we urge our European colleagues to do is stop looting Africa's resources. Africa will have enough to develop itself. Africans will not be migrating out of Africa into Europe. It is Europeans who will be migrating out of Europe into Africa like they did to impose colonialism to go after our resources. So the only way that migration can be stemmed is stop looting Africa.
Summits like the Italy-Africa Summit have come under sharp criticism from Pan-Africanists who believe that it is disrespectful for African leaders to keep attending such meetings. Ambassador Arikana Chihombori-Kwao, the former African Union ambassador to the United States, comments on the U.S.-Africa Summit held in December 2022.
President Biden would not pick up and go to meet with any other leader in the world without an agenda. That simply doesn't happen.
Right.
So what makes the U.S. think that they can engage African leaders without an agenda? Come to Washington, let me tell you what I want to do for you. Come to Washington, let me tell you what you need to do in your country. That game is an old game.
Right.
It's not going to work anymore. To be honest with you, if I'm to speak the truth, I hope a lot of heads of case don't come. Because it is an insult. It is an abuse of the African leaders. It's a disrespect of the African leaders. Where is the agenda? Please respect the African leaders. Do unto them what you would want done unto you.
Well, there has been a lot of criticism that African governments don't have a plan for Africa, and therefore the continent continues to be part of someone else's plan. Mr. Dea, our last question. What's your take on these increasingly common summits between some global imperialist powers and African leaders?
The problem that Africa faces is that many of our leaders have a mental affliction called schizophrenia. Sometimes their brain works, sometimes their brains don't. Sometimes they remember crucial things, sometimes they don't. They exercise some sort of confidence when they're facing their citizens. They totally lack self-confidence when they're facing their fellow leaders from the global north. Africa does have a plan. We have a very comprehensive plan. It's called the African Union Agenda 2063. In seven aspirations and in several programs beneath it, it addresses everything in Africa: democracy, governance, rule of law, human rights, development, engaging the youth, engaging women, and so on. So we do have a comprehensive plan. And the problem is sometimes our leaders forget that we have a plan or behave like we don't have a plan. Part of this plan, Aspiration 7, is Africa to engage the rest of the world from a position of mutuality and dignity. African heads of state trooping, falling over themselves to go meet some minor colonial power is going against Aspiration 7 of our own plan. So it's not that we don't have a plan. We have leaders that lack confidence and sometimes have forgetfulness issues. But clearly, my take on all these summits is we should punish our leaders for embarrassing us by trooping themselves like kids to go and listen to one leader at a time.
A very strong statement there. Africa has a strong plan, and leaders in this continent should face their counterparts across the world from a position of strength. I'd like to thank our guest there, Donald Dare, the Chief Executive Officer at the Pan-African Lawyers Union, for his incisive analysis today. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. From me, Mubarak Enes. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Almost 400 schools in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed during the Zionist regime's genocidal war. These schools previously served approximately 460,000 children and 17,000 teachers. According to United Nations estimates, at least 55% of schools will require either major repairs or complete reconstruction. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Khaled is a baby, born shortly before the Zionist regime declared its genocidal war on Gaza. He has spent most of his life in very unhealthy conditions. In the early stages of the war, his family had to evacuate their home in northern Gaza." Sahar, Khaled's mother, said, "We had to walk on streets filled with rubble. We were under constant bombardment. It was absolutely terrifying." Khaled's parents are unable to provide him with bare necessities. Diapers are scarce, so are infant formula and other food items. Sahar said, "He doesn't even have enough winter clothes or blankets to cover him during the cold nights." Khulood, a relative of Sahar, has a one-year-old son. Displaced and malnourished, Khulood is not able to produce sufficient breast milk for her child. Her son requires special diapers, as otherwise his skin becomes irritated. Finding them is impossible, Khulood said. Look at the prices. A pack of diapers costs $50, 100 grams of baby milk, $3, a pack of oats or wheat seeds, $7, a jar of honey around $50, the list goes on. She added, given these prices, it would cost us around $200 a week to take care of him. That's way more than we can afford. Mahmoud has fled Gaza City's beach refugee camp for Deir al-Balah in the middle area. His four-year-old son has started urinating in his sleep. Bedwetting is a known symptom of childhood trauma. The boy's life is truly miserable, Mahmoud, who has seven other children, said. He added, he is at the age where he should no longer be wearing diapers, but he must do so at nighttime now. Mahmoud is a fisher. It is too dangerous for him to ply his trade. Even before the current war, the Zionist regime was frequently attacking fishers. Mahmoud said, I have lost everything in this war. My home, my work, I have nothing left. It causes great pain to go back to my tent every single day and see this child crying for milk and bread. Mahmoud has left Al Rimal, a neighborhood in Gaza City, for Deir al-Balah. His wife is pregnant. Mahmoud said, I am extremely concerned about her and my next son. We are praying every single day that this war ends. I've lost my work, and we do not know what has happened to our home. I'm just baffled and bewildered. Ola Nasser has been devastated by the genocidal war on Gaza. Her husband and her son were killed when the Zionist regime attacked their neighbor's home in the southern city of Khan Yunis. She recalls that a very heavy and large missile fell on their house during the attack. Nasser was upstairs with her daughter, while her husband and son were downstairs. She said, suddenly I found myself on the street. I was on a pile of rubble. When she was brought to hospital, Nasser learned that her husband and son had been killed. My heart is still aches for the loss of everything, she said. My husband, my child, and the school where I worked. Nasser is a science teacher. Before the war, she was working in the Shajaya neighborhood of Gaza City. The area where my school was located is completely destroyed, Nasser said. Like so many others, she had hoped that the Zionist regime would spur schools, which have become shelters for displaced people. Nasser said, schools and hospitals are supposed to be safe places in the war. Almost 400 schools in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed during the current war. These schools previously served approximately 460,000 children and 17,000 teachers. According to United Nations estimates, at least 55% of schools will require either major repairs or complete reconstruction. Samia Salem taught math in Tel al-Hawa area of Gaza City before the war. She laments how Israeli regime troops laid siege to the area. Schools and other civilian infrastructures were shelled, she said. There will be no schooling for children this year. Then we will need a long period to restore everything. That means students could lose another year, and this will greatly affect their motivation and the level of their education. Salem fled Gaza City for Rafah in the south 2 months ago. With classes unable to function as normal, she had observed how children and parents are still trying to learn in a more informal setting. Many children in Gaza are reading and learning math in tents. Education has been repeatedly disrupted in Gaza over recent years, both because of Israel's attacks and the COVID-19 pandemic. Salem said, "We need to protect the schools. They must not be exposed to bombing and destruction. Every aspect of education has been affected. Kindergartens have even been attacked by the Zionist regime." Sadiq Al-Khuzur, spokesperson for the education ministry in Gaza, said, "Israel does not consider that Palestinians have a right to education. Israel has destroyed our schools and disrupted the process of scientific and intellectual development." Zoha Al-Daba is a 12-year-old girl from Al-Zaytun, east of Gaza City. Her family had to evacuate their home and head for Khan Yunis. She said, "The occupation destroyed my school. Why is Israel attacking education?" Zoha does not know how many children from her school have been martyred in this war. She said, "I miss books and school activities. I used to spend a long time in school. Now we spend all our time in a tent. I want my old routine back."
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
Such as gold.
Kingai.
King.
Gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
El oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name, and he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Five 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Byzant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500... Well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a 1,000-year coin, if you like.
The Byzant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Byzant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the Byzant survived for 1,000 years. The Byzant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you're a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population which had been devastated by the plague was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
From supporting the Zionist regime to not tackling Islamophobia, The main UK parties see the loss of Muslim votes as a price worth paying. Signs are growing that could prove costly come election day. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, Home Secretary James Cleverly and Foreign Secretary David Cameron were guests of honour at the annual Conservative Friends of Israel business lunch in central London 2 weeks ago. Former Zionist regime Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Tzipi Hatovli, the Zionist regime's ambassador to the UK, were also present along with 700 other guests. More than 100 days into the Gaza war, it is hard to think of a more powerful statement that the British government is fully on the side of Benjamin Netanyahu's Israel, regardless of 27,000 Palestinians dead. A few days earlier, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer had made his own public demonstration of his unqualified support for the fabricated regime of Israel when he addressed a Jewish Labour movement meeting in North London. He chose this moment to speak publicly for the first time about Labour's decision to drop its support for a Palestinian state. Peculiar timing, given Netanyahu's refusal to entertain a two-state solution. Starmer had not bothered to warn Hossam Zamlat, Palestinian head of mission in London, even though his remarks pertained to Palestine, not the Zionist regime. The message from the leaders of Britain's two main parties are stark. Neither is disturbed by the Zionist regime's atrocities and war crimes or the genocidal language used by the Zionist regime leaders up to and including the Zionist regime's president, Isaac Herzog, who spoke via video address alongside Sunak at the Conservative Friends of Israel business lunch. It's impossible that with either leader in charge, Palestinians could trust Britain to play any role in building peace when this conflict ends. The cross-party merger on Gaza is the latest and most egregious example of the unspoken agreement between the two political parties. Muslims should be at best ignored and at worst targeted and marginalized. Islamophobia is today rife within Labour, as Ali Milani, former Labour candidate against Boris Johnson in Oxbridge in 2019, highlighted in a devastating interview with the Middle East Eye. The Martin Ford report emphasized Labour's Islamophobia. More recently, a Labour Party source reportedly referred to Muslims leaving Labour as shaking off the fleas. Ugly, dehumanizing language. The Labour leadership seems to have decided that the loss of Muslim support is acceptable. Starmer's strategic focus is on what party insiders call hero voters, code for Labour supporters, many in northern constituencies who switched to Johnson's Tories in 2019. But the Conservative Party is worse, as they have set out in a series of investigative articles for Middle East Eye. The Tory organization persistently smears and targets Britain's Muslim minority. During Zach Goldsmith's 2016 campaign to be mayor of London, with the fabricated Trojan horse affair whipped up by the Tory government in alliance with a virulently Islamophobic mass media. The government attack on the nationwide ceasefire marches as hate marches is the latest case in the point. This exclusion of Britain's largest religious minority from mainstream politics is terrible for democracy and a disaster for social cohesion. For Britain's almost 4 million Muslim population, this creates an urgent problem. How should they vote in the looming general election given that so many of their concerns are ignored or despised by the two biggest political parties. The election could be called within weeks. If speculation that Sunak will choose May 2nd turns out to be correct, Muslims are mobilizing. Earlier this month came the bombshell announcement that British-Palestinian Lean Mohammed would run as an independent candidate in Ilford North against Shadow Health Secretary Wes String. The young activist was chosen after a hustings at Redbridge Community Action Group, which had promised to support a candidate that would be strong on Palestine, NHS, racism, Islamophobia, and the cost of living crisis. Elected as an MP in 2015, String is vulnerable. He has a majority of more than 5,000, which in normal circumstances should increase sharply with the Tories collapsing at the polls. But the circumstances are not normal. According to a 2021 census, the London borough of Redbridge, which contains Ilford North, has a 31% Muslim population, and polls suggest that Labour's support among the community has dropped as a result of its stance on Gaza. That drop in support is not enough to secure victory for Mohammed, but could be enough to cast String his majority. Last week, the human rights lawyer Tasnim Akuji declared that he will go head-to-head against the incumbent Labour MP, Roshanara Ali, in Bethnal Green and Stepency. Ali, who abstained rather than support last year's Commons vote to support a ceasefire in Gaza, secured a whopping majority of 37,524 in 2019, but 41,390, that is 40.1% of her electorate, is Muslim, making her less impregnable than she looks. Akuji told Middle East Eye, "I am standing because the incumbent did not give a voice to her constituents. She is a puppet on a string for a Starmer. The party system is not a force against democracy, rather than a force for democracy." As The Guardian reveals in a well-informed article, Starmer's office has begun polling British Muslim voters as fears rise about the damage done to their core vote. The damage is done. More independents are likely to emerge, many of them coordinated by a community-based campaign called The Muslim Vote, an initiative which bears comparison with the abandoned Biden campaign among Arab Americans, which is considered to have inflicted significant damage on Joe Biden's poll rating in the United States. The Muslim Vote TMV was launched on December 19th. It has been endorsed by Muslim Engagement and Development, the Muslim Association of Britain, the Muslim Council of Scotland, and Prevent Watch, among other groups. Its mission statement says, "We will no longer tolerate being taken for granted. We are a powerful united force of 4 million acting in unison. We are focused on seats where the Muslim vote can influence the outcome. We are here for the long term. In 2024, we will lay the foundations for our community's political future." Though not the first concerted attempt to galvanize the Muslim vote, it is the most powerful to date. TMV says it has thousands of volunteers and its campaign supporters collectively reach over 20 million people. It offers to come and help you determine whether your local area should put up an independent. It also offers to help with analyzing constituency data and with organizing a local campaign. The basic principle behind this initiative is, we will not back anyone who voted against or abstained on the ceasefire vote. We believe in devolved decision-making. Local communities will be empowered to back a candidate that is pro-Palestine and pro-peace. Pro-Palestinian candidates will need to be brave. Guido Fox, the right-wing website, has already launched the inevitable assault on Akuji, who is the lawyer of Shamima Begum, with the headline, "ISIS Bride Lawyer Stands Against Labour." Expect much more of the same.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on Imam Mehdi. Shiism thoroughly introduces the personality of the Savior. June 14, 2015. All Abrahamic religions believe in an end times Savior. All Abrahamic religions believe that someone will emerge who will save the world from the morass of oppression and cruelty. In Islam, the name of the Savior has been mentioned. All Islamic denominations refer to this divine person and this great and extraordinary individual as Mehdi. Perhaps there is no Islamic denomination that does not believe Mehdi alayhi salam will emerge. He is a descendant of the Holy Prophet. Islamic denominations have even specified the name and epithet of that noble man. The feature of Shia ideology is that it thoroughly and clearly introduces this personality. It considers him as the son of the 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. From the viewpoint of Shia historians and writers, his birth date is completely clear. Most of other Islamic denominations have not specified his birth date or they have not accepted it, but the Shia prove the existence and birth date of that great personality with strong and cogent reasons. Some people have dismissed the possibility of the existence and survival of a person over this long time. This is the only question that opponents have raised regarding Imam Mehdi alayhi salam. However, the Holy Quran dispels this doubt with its clear words. The Holy Prophet says about Prophet Noah, "We sent Noah to his people, and he tarried among them 1,000 years less 50." The Holy Quran, chapter 29, verse 14. This does not mean that he lived for 950 years. It apparently means that his mission to invite people to God lasted for 950 years. Therefore, this questioning is groundless.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The greatest quality of belief in Mahdawiya is creating hope. June 14, 2015. The greatest characteristic of this belief among Shias is that it engenders hope. The Shia community is not reliant only on its prominent historical events in the past. It also looks forward to the future. A person who believes in the issue of Mahdawiya on the basis of Shia ideology does not empty his heart of hope even in the most difficult circumstances. There is always a ray of hope in the heart of such a person. They know that this dark era and this era of oppression and illegitimate domination will definitely come to an end. This is one of the most important results and achievements of this belief. Of course, Shia belief in the issue of Mahdawiya is not confined to this point. People all over the world feed from his blessings, and the heavens and the earth gain strength thanks to his existence. Such is the belief in Mahdawiya. This bright flame and this shining light has existed in Shia societies in the course of past centuries, and it will continue to exist. By Allah's favor, the era of anticipation will come to an end.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of the 12th Imam, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Congratulations to all of our Muslim listeners on this auspicious occasion.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In yet another rally to support the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They chanted slogans supporting Palestinian resistance and condemned the Arab world's indifference toward Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
The Yemeni people were raised since their childhood to love and adore Palestine and to love jihad in Palestine. Therefore, when the opportunity arose to have an influential position under the leadership of Ansarullah, they did not hesitate and went out to the streets, believing that their protests were jihad for the sake of God, as the least duty as long as the borders were not opened for them, and they were not able to fight with the Palestinians.
A message to the European peoples. Your governments today are contributing to genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza by submitting to America's orders to militarize the Red Sea. America involves you in its own problems. The solution to stopping the Red Sea operations is to stop the aggression against Gaza and lift the siege. This is the easiest solution. But if your government wants to submit to America's orders, you will see what we will teach. I mean, you will see that we will teach America a lesson that will never forget. And if you attack us, you will unfortunately meet the same fate.
Protesters praised the recent operations by the Yemeni army, including the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. They also celebrated the introduction of the submarine weapon into the Yemeni army's arsenal, believing it will enhance the success of Yemen's naval operations.
The submarines introduced by Abdul Malik al-Houthi are one of the surprises that the enemy is going to face if it continues its aggression against Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces, specifically the Yemeni Navy, still have surprises coming, a wide range of targets, and also a superior ability to obtain information at any time and place. Therefore, these are successive military messages, the content of which is that we will escalate further as long as Israel's war in Gaza continues, and Yemen has the upper hand in its waters, and this position will never change.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army announced that they have successfully carried out three military operations. The first operation involved launching multiple ballistic missiles and drones against various targets in Eilat-occupied Palestine. The other two attacks targeted an American destroyer and the British vessel Islander in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. He added that the British ship was set on fire as a result of the attack.
Every Friday, people gather here affirming that they will never tire of taking to the streets to show support for the oppressed people of Palestine as long as the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza continues. They believe it is the least that all Muslims around the world should do as a religious duty toward the innocent civilians of Palestine. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, the International Court of Justice